Hi, everybody. This is your host, Robin Gao. I use it, fae, and he, him pronouns. And I'm here today again with another episode of QLV, where we talk about all things queer in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. And I'm so excited to have another special guest today, Jinx, who is an amazing poet, activist, and many other amazing things, an all-around kind person. And I'm really excited for our conversation today. I thought we could start off by just introducing yourself a little bit, tell the audience about whatever part of yourself you want to start with. You do a lot of things.
Yeah, I do a lot of things. Hello. My name is Jinx Leonard. I use she, her, they, them pronouns. As Robin says, I am an activist. I am also a poet, a writer. I do so many things.
I saw you just yesterday yeah. at the Trans Day of Visibility event, which was really beautiful. Were you there with NEPA Stands Up or just on your own?
I was there with NEPA Stands Up. NEPA Stands Up is a grassroots organization that I work with. I moved here from Virginia, and I didn't, like, know anyone. And then I was struggling to find community. Mm. And then after my arrest, they were really helpful with, like, the legal process. They were supportive, like, doing the hearing and whatnot. They had, like, a group of people there. And I felt like I was finally part of a community. And I decided to help with their standing cause, because there's so many, like, organizations, but having an organization help someone that you don't even know that
well.
Yeah,
that's really meaningful.
It's really meaningful. And, like, NEPA Stands Up is a grassroots organization. Grassroots organization pretty much means is that they get all their money from members, and they don't get it from sponsorships, they don't get it from corporations, they don't get any donations from billionaires. We get it from the people, and we use that to work with, like, issues that we believe that needs to be fixing, like Alec Walker Serrano, who spoke at TDOV. He is the leadership for the queer community with that. So basically, knowing your rights, knowing your history, knowing what bills are for and against, especially trans people nowadays. Mm-hmm. And we also have, we're working on a housing community as well.
Oh, that's awesome.
Because a lot of this stuff is corresponding in intersectionality as well. So, like, housing, queer, comes together.
Oh,
and
for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And we're doing, like, a nice housing survey as when it comes to that. And yeah, we get, like, wonderful people. We endorse our own candidates that we believe that actually make a difference, like Megan Kocher and Fern Lear, who are both, like, these amazing people who had been struggling, who's been homeless, who's been in poverty, who's been, like, a single parent raising a kid while going down to the capital of D.C. to fight for bills that they believe that needs to be fight for. And I think just this election alone, we stole 40,000 votes from conservatives and Republicans in our area in NEPA.
That's really awesome. It sounds like that's really meaningful work to be able to work for a group of people that you can direct where the attention goes.
Yes.
Instead of being guided by any external forces, you can guide yourselves. I saw, is it like a queer, is it called the Queer Committee, or is what the specific group that focuses on queer issues with Pennsylvania Stands Up?
It's a, at first it was called, like, the LGBTQ Alliance Community, but with everything that's been going on, we switched it to the Queer Liberation Committee.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
How long has that been active?
I believe it's been active ever since Alec has, like, became a leader, one of the leaders in our chapel, because Pennsylvania Stands Up is a tree, and we're just sort of like a sub-branch of that tree.
Oh, that's cool.
So pretty much, like, ever since Alec came into the organization, he was just like, I want to do things for queer people. And, like, pretty much our leader of our chapter, Holly, was just like, okay, cool, let's do that.
That's awesome.
And so pretty much anything that, like, Holly wanted to do and Alec wanted to do, we will, like, make things such as, like, a Troublemakers Cafe, like, knowing your rights, knowing how we can educate you more on, like, especially everything that's going on with immigration laws.
Yeah.
Like, especially,
it's really scary.
Yeah. In Lehigh Valley, they're focusing on immigration and the deportation. Lehigh Valley Stands Up. Yeah. And I'm, like, sort of like a co-leader when it comes to the queer liberation. I remember the first thing that I wanted to do was just, like, it's great to have, like, all these amazing, amazing things such as, like, knowing your rights and history, but we also have to celebrate queer joy.
For sure.
For sure. And so when I wanted to do, I bit off more than I could chew, but I was like, let's do a music and arts and crafts festival. And it got way out of hand, and the city of Wilkes-Barre was just like, we're shutting this down. And so, unfortunately, it didn't happen. But, hey, you never know. It might happen in the future.
Yeah, you kind of plan those pathways, and, you know, some, the people who are interested are probably still there. So sometimes there's – I feel like everybody who's ever organized anything has always had something like that happen. So, you know, you start building those roots, and something will grow eventually. But that's really beautiful. And I really appreciate what you said about, like, having those spaces for queer joy alongside with, you know, the – fight for our equal rights.
Yeah.
Because we gotta have a balance or we'll be sad. Yeah. And what would you say, like, your favorite things to be involved with when it comes to that kind of activism work? From what I've seen, I think it's really beautiful what the group is doing in terms of really making sure the people who are most impacted are speaking to the issues, because I think sometimes that can be a problem that I often see. People often ask me about, like, what issues I think are impacting the community most, and I'm usually like, housing, employment, yeah. Stuff like getting our basic economic needs met. So I guess I'm curious, like, what part of that makes you feel passionate, what issues you feel most drawn to working with? I mean, I know they all intersect, but I'm just curious.
I think for me, the issues that I feel more important for is, like, the queer issues,
mm-hmm.
and especially being a Black trans woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I'm the more visible Black minority,
mm-hmm.
I feel like, in NEPA alone.
That's really fair.
And so I feel like I have to make myself like I wouldn't call myself a spotlight, mm-hmm. but I have to make myself an example for both of my communities as a trans woman and also as a Black woman. And really, I feel like the passionate with that of just connecting with people.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people, like, they could probably heard of us from mm-hmm. something, but they don't know what we do.
Yeah.
Like, when I first moved here to from PA, I learned about them, but I didn't know what they did until I actually joined the community. And I've done, like, activism work when I was still, like, cis in North Carolina and stuff, mm-hmm. but it's just, it felt like really white savior.
Yeah, that's hard.
With a lot of it. And so it was just like they were using me as just like, hey, you know, we are not problematic. We have a Black one.
Yeah, that tokenization. And then I think that can also, from my, not exactly the same experience, but from other experiences of feeling tokenized, it can be like, there's a lot of weight too, because you're trying to make sure good things still get done, but at the same time also feeling like all the pressure of like representing a group that's not being equally represented in an organization or whatever kind of effort that is. So I'm glad that it sounds like the newer space that you're in feels more connected and equal and able to like connect with community members, because being visible, like we've been talking about it because it was just Trans Day of Visibility, but it really is powerful in a lot of ways, and I'm sure like your presence in NEPA is like really valuable. I know that I lived a little bit in the Northeast and I found it very isolating.
Yeah.
Because there's just not as many spaces where there's out queer people, out trans people, but I can see that building and it's really beautiful to watch. And I love how like our regions really interact too. Like people from the Lehigh Valley do stuff in NEPA and people from NEPA come here to, you know, build that community together. So it's really powerful. Do you have any like recent like goals that NEPA Stands Up is like working on in terms of activism, or any like personal goals that tend to guide you through that kind of work?
So NEPA Stands Up is working on our housing community. Like I said before, they're doing like a nice communal housing survey.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty much we're getting information from everyone from NEPA, asking them, like, is your housing safe?
Mm-hmm.
Is it disability accessible?
Yeah.
Is it like clean from pollution? We want to know so we can pinpoint where we need to target.
Yeah.
And like we said before, into intersectionality of being queer and also housing, it comes to hand two and two. So we're trying to do a lot of like rent control bills to pass through, because everywhere wants to be a metropolitan area, but they don't want to do the work or the funding to have like public transportation to be a metropolitan area.
Yeah.
So we are trying to find a way to like help freeze control. We're also, Holly, bless her heart, is doing amazing work with the few homeless shelters that we do have in NEPA,
mm-hmm.
because we have the worst winter this winter, past winter, current winter, if we still...
Yeah, because it's still cold.
It's second winter.
Pennsylvania, but, yeah.
but Holly has the personal sheriff's phone number and me like, hey, it's like 20 degrees. We need to open up the shelters. And like Holly and everyone is trying to find like people who can work and volunteer for the housing shelters. And we're also trying to find some shelters that are not rooted in religious intentions, because a lot of people, especially a lot of queer folks, have a lot of religious trauma, and they don't need to feel guilty for being homeless for something that's out of their control.
Yeah, for sure. And I know that some of those organizations would be exempt from like some of the fair housing stuff because they might not receive any government dollars, and so sometimes the religious organizations can, and like there's great religious organizations too, but at the same time there's also ones that are discriminatory, or even just like you said, like people just might not feel comfortable or feel safe. And you're in a really vulnerable state if you're like trying to seek shelter. So you want people to feel comfortable. And that's such important work. Yeah, I feel like every time anyone asks me to talk about what's going on in the community, I'm like, the housing crisis, it's everywhere. And I'm sure it's really, really hard in NEPA, because like you said, I don't think that there's many shelters up there.
No, I think there's only three that I know of, and one of them is not properly staffed.
Yeah. Well, it's really great that you're doing that kind of advocacy work then, and, you know, hopefully spreading enough awareness that we can get to a point where there's more, more, and not just shelters, but more sustainable housing for people to live lives in safety and dignity, because we all need housing. I think that the other question that I was curious about, since you talked a little bit about moving, I was curious how you feel like the activism or advocacy space is different from, you said that you came from Virginia, you lived in, did you say North Carolina?
Yeah, North Carolina.
So how are the two different spaces kind of different?
Yeah, I was rooted in privilege when growing up. So I didn't get really active in my activism until after I transitioned, surprisingly. But like when all the Black Lives Matters coming out from all the police killings from 2018 to like 2020, I became more socially aware with what was going on. Before that, when I was living in Asheville, North Carolina, I was like going to queer centers because I was like finally coming to terms with my sexuality at that point. And it was just really, like I said before, Asheville, North Carolina was really like liberal. Like, oh, we're doing such a good thing, but they say that they were doing such a good thing. Like, they're like, yeah, we're having a queer outing. But I'm like, okay, but what about these bills that are going through? And like, fight the good fight. And then when I moved back up to Virginia for a little bit, it was like the height of COVID.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I was homeless at the time, so I couldn't like focus on my activism. But it radicalized me.
Yeah.
And I was just like, a lot of people didn't understand. I volunteered my own time while I was homeless at a soup kitchen.
Yeah.
And I was just like, no one should feel like they're not deserving of basic necessities.
Yeah, for sure.
But like seeing the difference between being up here and being down there, because I was living in Northern Virginia, which is a metropolitan area.
I see.
So like 15 minutes away from D.C. And everyone was like so individualistic. They were only there for themselves. Like I remember someone was just like, oh, yeah, I'm only volunteering for school credit.
Okay.
But moving up here and being actively in the community, I realized that there's something beautiful about a small town community.
Yeah, for sure.
And a lot of people tend to be like, oh, I got to get out of like Lehigh Valley. I got to get out of Allentown. I got to get out of NEPA. But I lived the city life. It's not great.
I hear that.
It's full of like, it's that individualism, your number.
Yeah.
Even though there are amazing communities like in Pittsburgh, as we saw at TDOD.
Yeah, for sure.
The sister, and then also in Philly. But it was just at the same time, you have to hustle to survive for your basic necessities. Well, here in the small community like NEPA or Lehigh Valley or like Eastern PA, it's just beautiful that people come up to me that I don't even know. They're like, Jinx, thank you for all the work that you do while I'm pumping gas. And I'm like, you know what?
That's nice.
That's nice. That's nice to hear.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's really beautiful. I love hearing about your whole process and journey of kind of like how you've landed in your activism now. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back and talk about your poetry and writing, which I'm super excited about.
For the past 3 decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to this service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610-694-8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to QLV. I'm your host, Robin, here with our guest, Jinx. And we're going to talk a little bit about your poetry and writing, which is how I've met you, because we're both poets.
Yeah, we met at a Firefly bookstore.
Yes. Just, I would love to hear, tell us a little bit about your writing. How did you start writing? You now have a book and you have another one coming out, but I'd love to hear about how you started writing.
Yeah, definitely. So I started writing like back when I was like 8 years old. I was always an avid of like creating different things. I was doing a lot of like silly, cringy fan fiction things, because as we all do, we're queer. But I didn't have that representation that I wanted growing up.
Yeah.
And I realized that when I was like reading I was forced to read Harry Potter because I have a reading comprehension disability and also a little bit of dyslexia. So it was just hard for me to comprehend what was going on in books.
Yeah.
And I remember I was like reading Harry Potter. I was reading the first 3 chapters, and I think I asked my mom as I was reading it, and I was like, is Harry Potter white? And she was like, yeah. And I was like, I don't care about this. and so I was just like, I got to find my representation, because the things I had growing up was just full of trauma, full of generational. Like, it was always about gangs. It was about the dangers of gangs and, like, falling into them. It was about black boys going to jail. It was about all this stuff in generational trauma, or it was just about historical trauma.
Yeah.
With like, oh, this is what we went through. And I'm like, that's nice, but I'm a nerd. Can I have like a black magical girl doing things? And I remember one day I was just like, well, no one's going to do it. Yeah. I might as well do it. And I think that's the one thing a lot of people tend to get really upset about me. It's just like, yeah, I actively proudly admit that I'm not an avid reader. I want to be. Mm-hmm. I really do. But I can't. It's hard for me to relate to other people's stories when I didn't have that growing up.
Yeah, that's really fair.
Yeah, and so now I'm trying to go back into my reading, and I'm like, I want to read about black queer stories, and then maybe I'll get into Becky's romantic issues.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. But that's really fair, and there's actually like a lot of really clear statistics and studies that show that when kids are provided with more diverse books that represent them, that people's reading scores increase, that their participation in school increases. And if you don't see that representation, then like, why would you care? You know, like,
is that why you became a young adult? Oh, I'm so sorry. Is that why you became a young adult author?
Probably. I mean, I love writing for kids because I love getting to write books that I didn't have as a kid. Yeah. And I'm really glad that I think that we're living in a time now where there seems like there's a lot more.
Yeah,
there's a lot more queer authors. There's a lot more queer authors of color. There's a lot more queer disabled authors writing stories that, like, I feel like represented by a lot more. It's really great to see, because I totally hear you. Like, when I was growing up, I don't think that I can think of – I can only remember, like, one book with, like, even just, like, a white gay character.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, not a lot going on there. But, yeah, it's true, though. I resonate with that experience of being like, well, I can't find it, so you kind of have to create it. And I think that like sometimes there's so many ways that like media influences us. Like, we learn as writers not just through reading books, but through all different kinds of media. And my next question was like, who do you feel like your influences are for writing? And that doesn't have, like I said, doesn't have to be books. It could be movies. It could be musicians.
Yeah, definitely. So growing up writing, I was a big, I'm still am, but I'm a big anime fan.
Cool.
And so, like, a lot of my inspiration came from both, like, the Japanese history and how that country mm-hmm. has been made, and also, like, the feudal Japan, like, all the wars with that. But also just, like, how the writing tropes from anime was, like, clear cut on what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, this is great. And then there was, like, a shift, and there was, like, big plot twists, and I'm like, this is even better.
Yeah.
But when I transitioned, a lot, I was, like, thirsting for, like, queer stories.
Yeah,
and I was,
yeah.
like, looking for it. And, like, two of my biggest inspirations were two movies I saw. Mm-hmm. I saw the TV Glow, which was amazing, like, metaphorical about the dangers of nostalgia and escapism, yeah. but also it was a beautiful trans story that mm-hmm. I relate to extremely hard. And then the other one I saw was The People's Joker by mm-hmm. Vera Drew, which is like this parody on using the Batman's IP to tell the director's coming out story.
Oh, wow.
And like also it had a wonderful message about the dangers and the pitfalls of an abusive T4T relationship, which we don't usually get.
Yeah, for sure. That's really always nuanced and beautiful to have like a place to talk about that.
And that one's just like so unapologetically trans. And I was just like, I want to write things like this as well. Just something unapologetically.
Yeah.
And it's like both in having both of them, one being more metaphorical mm-hmm. and like out there and like have a lot of subtext, and the other one's just like, I'm trans.
Yeah.
And so and it's just like, it's good to have both.
Yeah, for sure. I think that it's great that we're getting to a place with narratives where there's so much diversity in that too, because I think there's like so much value to both kinds of approaches to talking about transness. I saw the TV Glow is probably like one of my favorite movies I've ever seen, but it's like really hard for me to rewatch because it's I find it devastating. that's like the only word I can use to describe it. And I think it's so interesting because I really only think that trans people like feel that way about it. Like I've never met a cis person who like completely gets it. And we don't have to talk about I Saw the TV Go forever, but it's but I could talk about it forever. And I think that it's a really beautiful, striking movie. And I appreciate that you brought that up as an influence.
Yeah.
So you write both poetry and short stories, and I was curious about what draws you to the different mediums. Like, when you sit down to write, are you like, I know I'm going to write a poem, or do you just kind of follow wherever that narrative or idea takes you, and it comes out a poem or it comes out a short story?
Oh, yeah. I definitely have, like, I love to do, like, one-sentence synopsis. So when I'm doing, like, my poetry, I usually have one line, and that's the stinger, and I write the poem around that one line to make
cool.
it sure it works like that. And then for a one of my short stories, I usually write a question. I'm like, what if like your best friends were trying to help you come out through a D&D campaign? And that's like and that can be like a story on itself. Mm-hmm. And you just if it works, it works. I wrote like 12, maybe 15 different stories. Mm. And some of them I was just like, wow, no one's going to get this except for me. And so I like tossed it out. But yeah, it's like I think that's like my thought process and my creative process with a lot of my writing. It's mm-hmm. just basically one big question and a lot of subtext questions. Because right now I'm working on a romance sapphic novel of like a city girl going back to her hometown, and it became this really progressive area, and she's basically trying to cope with of how like she didn't have that community growing up, and it's like really good, and it's like it got inspired by my pinball group Bells and Chimes in Scranton, and I was just like, this sounds like a really good thing. I've written so many novels with like stuff like that, but they're always collecting dust. But who knows? They may come out one day.
Yeah. I mean, that's the good thing about writing is, like, you can always go back. Those things are not done. At least, well, in our age of technology, you can kind of just reopen the file. And that sounds really cool. I'm always down for reading a sapphic novel. There's never enough.
There's never enough.
That sounds really cool. So what has publishing been like for you? You have a book out now that's been out, I think you said, like, a year and a half or a little bit over that.
Year or some change,
Yeah. What have the triumphs been like? What have the challenges been like of being a published author?
So I am a self-published author.
Mm-hmm.
unfortunately, I was going to go to school to be a like an author and creative writing as my major. But unfortunately, I didn't have the resources to continue. But so I self-published. I had – it was a weird time because I was sending this out while I was homeless because I was like, this is going to get me out of poverty for some reason. I really thought it was – I was like, this is going to get me out of poverty. But I didn't publish it until after I found stability in my home in PA. But I really enjoyed – the process of like going to people and trying to sell this. I'm just like, yeah, poems and short stories. It's like, it's easy to pick up, put down. It's something unapologetically. There's no like metaphors. It's directly right in your face. These are trans characters. And I was trying to do that for a lot of these publishers. And a lot of them was just like, due to the climate of what's going on, I don't think this is going to sell well. Maybe you want to hold on to it. And, but I was like, but we need this now.
Yeah, for sure.
We need this representation now. And after like the sixth, maybe seventh publisher I went to, I was like, I can't handle another rejection.
Yeah.
And so I decided to self-publish through one of the many self-publishing programs that we have nowadays. Unfortunately, I published through Amazon KDP, but unfortunately, it's the most accessible and thing for writing. And so I published it, and then I was like talking to different stores, and they're like, if you can get us the books, we will be more than happy to sell to you, sell it here. So I was like researching. I was like, how can I do it? And I found out you can just buy tons of author copies
and
sell them yourself like that and get your money back after your 10th copy. And so that's what I did. And it was really interesting because I really thought it was going to be more of, oh, I have to like, I mean, listen, bucko, this book is going to sell like hotcakes. I'm telling you. But a lot of people took a chance on me. The first place I ever hosted my book, South Street Art Mart over in Philly, I just basically came up there to them one day and was just like, hey, I have a book. You want to sell it here? And they're like, sure. I didn't have to like convince them, which made me feel kind of like identity crisis of like, oh, am I actually good? Or they're just being nice to me. So I gave them a copy of my book and I was just like, read this first, and if you think it can sell in your store, please let me know. And then they read it, and they were like, this is amazing, and I sold like 40 copies there.
That's so awesome.
Far. Yeah. Around this time of the recording of this, I think I sold around 500 books.
That's amazing.
Just by word of mouth.
I will tell you that that is more than a lot of not self-published books, like especially poetry. It's a hard market, so like that's really awesome. And sometimes the channels that are supposed to help us don't help us, and we gotta self-publish or get it out there some way. And you know, sometimes that also builds to getting connected to something else if you ever want to go a different route. But
exactly.
It does give you some self like control around like where your book goes, where it lands. But that's really awesome. I feel like that Art Mart, I've been there before, and I just know that I always see a bunch of trans people there, and I'm like, that is a perfect place for your book. I'm sure that there's a lot of people who can resonate with everything in it from there. Would you like to read a little portion of one of your poems to wrap us up?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm actually going to read something from the new book.
Oh, really? Awesome. Yeah. Yay. Wow. Oh, my gosh. Preview.
A preview. So this one is like the closer of the book from The Rules of Estrogen, coming out April 30th. And it's called Soft Black Woman. And it's one of my favorite. It's like my mantra. So it goes a little something like this. I am a woman. And I know that's hard for you to understand, so please let me say it again. I am a black woman. The trans is only an adjective after you respect me. I speed ran the hardening of my skin to protect me, but not to mold me, for I had no mother to show me and no father to teach me. But at the end of the day, I am a woman. And I know that's hard for you to comprehend, so please let me say it again. I am a black woman. The trans is only an adjective after you comprehend me. I love to feel soft. I love to feel girly, not because I am a girl, but because this world would deem me something more than a monster. But if someone can look past that and to make me giggle and to make me blush, I realize even someone like me as a monster can be a natural woman. And Miss Franklin knew what's what. So one more time, let me just say that I am a soft, black, trans woman. This identity is mine in the softness of my skin, is in the dresses that I don, is even in the makeup that I wear, and you can see it, that I am everything that I was meant to be.
Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. That was really beautiful. So thanks to everybody for tuning in. This was QLV, Queer Lehigh Valley, and I'm your host, Robin Gao, and this has been a conversation with me and Jinx. So.
Thank you for having me.